cosmological constant, non-problem. If there is a problem with hearing or anything like that, please interrupt immediately. Otherwise, we'll just continue. Eugenio, it is good if you could tell us when you change the slide, and also if you can tell us, if you can pause at the end of each part so that people can ask questions. Thank you. Eugenio, please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much for inviting me to give this talk. The talk is based on many discussions and on two papers we have written recently together with Carlo Rovelli. And the point is that we believe that there is something scientifically very wrong in the way the origin of cosmic acceleration is often presented. You often hear seminars or read in the literature statements like, we are facing the great mystery of the nature of dark energy, or a mysterious substance that makes 75% of our universe. There is no great mystery. The phenomenon of cosmic acceleration is well understood in the context of general relativity with a cosmological constant. So why all this prejudice against a constant? Well, in these two papers we argue, and in this talk, we argue that the common theoretical objections to a cosmological constant are either weak or ill-founded. Okay, we can go to slide number two, the outline. As you know, the universe is expanding, and observations indicate that its expansion is speeding up. And to account for this acceleration, a mysterious substance, dark energy, is often invoked. And it is argued that the underlying physics is unknown. Now, there is a simple explanation that is to end. The cosmic acceleration is predicted and simply described by general relativity, with a cosmological constant, with a positive cosmological constant. In fact, the standard model of cosmology, the lambda CDM model, assumes the presence of a cosmological constant and provides the best account of the present observational data. Well, there are three objections to the cosmological constant that are commonly presented, and they nourish the mystery. So in this talk, I will discuss them. The talk is divided into three parts. The first part is about what is called the Einstein's blunder. The second, the problem of cosmic coincidence. And the third, vacuum energies in quantum field theory and their contribution, hypothetical contribution to the cosmological constant. What we argue is that there is confusion, historical or conceptual, in each of these counter-arguments to the cosmological constant.
Okay. Can I ask a clarifying question?
Yes,
Eugenio, so suppose I accept that the cosmological constant is a constant which is a parameter in Einstein's equations. Isn't it still worthy of investigation what the value of that constant is and why there is such a huge ratio with the Planck constant, with the Planck scale?
Yes, I think it's an important question. So I'll try to discuss it in the third part of the talk. So I'll go back to this question about the magnitude of the cosmological constant and its ratio to the Planck length.
Okay.
So we can go to slide number three. Lambda, Einstein's greatest blunder. So I've taken this quote from George Gamow's informal autobiography. He says, much later, when I was discussing cosmological problems with Einstein, he remarked that the introduction of the cosmological term was the biggest blunder he ever made in his life. So let's see what is this blunder. Slide four. In 1916, in his paper on the foundation of the general theory of relativity, Einstein introduces a lambda term in his equations. And 1 year later, when investigating the cosmological consequences of general relativity, he fine-tuned the lambda term in order to have a static universe. Well, this was before 1929, when Hubble found observational evidence for the expansion of the universe. Now, the story that is often told is that Einstein, and after him the relativity community, rejected lambda, the cosmological constant, as it spoils the beauty of general relativity, just to account for apparent staticity. Well, this is nonsense. Lambda does not spoil the beauty of general relativity. The true blunder is that Einstein missed a prediction, the prediction of the cosmic expansion before its discovery, because he failed to see that without a cosmological constant, or with a generic value of the cosmological constant, and even with a fine-tuned value because of the instability, the universe is not static, it is expanding. The cosmological constant is an integral part of general relativity. The theory has two fundamental constants, the Newton constant and the cosmological constant, and they have to be determined experimentally. Now, as observational data about a non-vanishing cosmological constant are relatively recent. In slide 5, can you go to slide 5, I discuss the discovery of cosmic acceleration in 1998. This was possible thanks to two breakthroughs of the beginning of the 90s. The first is the demonstration that type 1A supernova are standard candles, and the second is the deployment of large mosaic CCD cameras on 4 meter telescopes. This enabled the systematic search for large areas of the sky for these rare events. Now, comparing images taken weeks apart, the discovery of a supernova at redshift order 0.5 could be scheduled on a statistical basis. There are two independent teams, the one of Perlmutter and the one of Rees, that took advantage of these breakthroughs and measured the supernova Hubble diagram to a much larger distance than was possible before. And both teams independently found that distant supernovae are dimmer than they would be in a decelerating universe. And this indicates that the expansion has been speeding up for the past 5 billion years. Now, when these data are analyzed, assuming a universe with matter and cosmological constant, the results provide evidence for a positive cosmological constant. Now, to understand why a positive cosmological constant, I want to go back briefly to the theory, slide 6. Because observational data are often presented in terms of a diagram that I want to describe. So this is the diagram on the right in slide 6. How does it work? You see a standard Friedman equation in the first equation with a cosmological term. And, in the presence of a cosmological constant, there is a wide range of possible behaviors of the universe. For instance, the standard law that the closed universe recollapses is no longer true, as shown here in the diagram, nor that the open universe expands forever. Now, a useful way to visualize possible behaviors is to focus on two parameters that are defined in the second equation. The present density parameter for cosmological constant and the present matter density, omega matter. So the diagram on the right is the diagram omega lambda, omega matter. And you can see the line omega lambda plus omega matter equal 1. Okay? It is the one that gives a flat universe and it divides the plane into open and closed cosmologies. Now, let's try to identify in this plane where we have an accelerating universe. An excellent assumption is to assume that matter in the present universe is pressureless. In this case, the acceleration is for omega lambda larger than 1/2 omega matter. This is the line that separates accelerating from decelerating. The situation where you have an approximately flat universe, it is accelerating, is identified by a point like the red dot that you see in the diagram. Okay? Now, let's go back to equations. The fourth equation, the acceleration equation. From this equation, you see that if you want to have cosmic acceleration, a double dot positive, either you need a positive cosmological constant, or you have to admit that matter today can have an exotic equation of state. Okay, this is theory. Now, let's go to the observational status, slide 7. And you can see, superposed to the theory diagram, the observational data coming from supernovae, from the CMB, and from baryonic acoustic oscillation. Okay, this data are fitted using the standard model of cosmology, the lambda cold dark matter model. It gives for the density parameter the following observed values. You can see 0.76, order 0.76 for omega lambda, and order 0.24 for omega matter. And in the third equation, the deceleration parameter is, notice the name, the historical name, deceleration. Deceleration was expected. It is negative, it is 0.64, and notice the precision, 1%. We were saying blunder. This is a success of Einstein's general relativity. A success of Einstein's general relativity with a cosmological constant that corresponds to a radius of curvature of 10 to the 26 meters. On the other hand, in the matter sector, there is an exciting mystery. There's the cold dark matter component that has been observed only gravitationally. Okay, this concludes my first part. Are there questions, or I should say, I know that there are cosmologists, are there comments on things they want to add? Otherwise, we can go to the second part, slide number 8, the cosmic coincidence problem. It is the question why the density parameter for matter and for cosmological constant are of the same order of magnitude now, as shown in this diagram that I've taken from a review by Kolb. Okay, let's go to slide 9. So this cosmic coincidence is taken as an argument against the cosmological constant scenario. As you see, they are of the same order of magnitude in a narrow band. Data indicate that we happen to live in a very brief phase of cosmic history where these two parameters are of the same order of magnitude. And this is an unlikely coincidence and clashes with the cosmological principle. It's good to put in numbers and to go to densities instead of density parameters. The density of matter today is 10 to the minus 23 grams per meter cube. To figure out what is this number, well, a galaxy is order 10 to the 11 stars, solar masses, and two galaxies are at this average distance of 1 megaparsec. And this density scales in time as the scale parameter A to the minus 3. On the other hand, the cosmological constant corresponds to an energy density that is constant. It happens to be of the same order of magnitude. Yeah. Now you see on the right bottom the picture for the ratio of the density of baryons compared to the density of a cosmological constant, and you see in detail this narrow coincidence. So this is often used as an argument to argue that the acceleration is in fact not due to a constant, but to a fluid dark energy with a density that varies in time. And you need to have an exotic equation of state with negative pressure in order to account for acceleration. Okay, this is the standard coincidence argument. Now let's go to slide number 10, where we ask, How unlikely is this coincidence? Is it a very brief phase? Well, you know, probability arguments are often tricky and should be handled with care. So, in particular, why should we assume equiprobability on a logarithmic scale? Equiprobability in proper time is more reasonable. And on the right, you see this picture where the ratio is plotted against the against the scale factor. Now, when this is done, you see that the short phase lasts, in fact, half the life of the universe. So this puts the problem back into perspective. It's not a fine-tuned coincidence. It is an issue of order or magnitude. The question is, why do we happen to live in an age of the universe that is not many order of magnitude smaller or larger? Now, when formulated in this way, one can go to this second point, that is the cosmological principle. We already know that it cannot be applied uncritically. For instance, we don't live in a random place in the universe. The density around us is not 10 to the minus 23 grams per meter cube. It's the density of rocks. And similarly, it's quite reasonable that we can live only during those few giga years. Okay, this concludes my second part about the coincidence problem. Are there questions?
I do have a comment, which is that, as you very nicely pointed out, if I look at the matter density, it is always falling like 1 upon a cube, and it is very, very large near the Big Bang, and it's diluting. And the cosmological constant density is always constant, and therefore, if I were just to plot these two lines of densities against time, then it is clear that they're going to cross somewhere. And if they were going to cross, I don't know, another billion years from today, then those people would again be asking, why now? So I never kind of understood in detail the argument about this coincidence problem. I mean, it's really putting in slightly different words what you were saying about it could be really happening. It's not such a sharp time period. It's really a large window, and the two are going to get comparable if there is any cosmological constant at all at some stage. So to me, it's not such a... I mean, if it is correlated with something else in addition, we learn something. But I don't see this as a problem in its own right.
Can I make a comment here? Because, I mean, it seems to me the point of puzzles is not to have a philosophical argument about their plausibility. The point of puzzles is to generate hypotheses. And as you mentioned, the hypothesis that this issue generated was quintessence, the idea that maybe there is a dynamical relation between the dark energy and the matter energy density, which evolves dynamically in time. And that's led to an experimental research program to try to measure the parameter W, which you know, to see if it is minus one or something different. Now, do you believe so strongly that this is not a problem that you would urge astronomers not to spend money to measure W more accurately?
I think is it to Eugenio or is it to me, Lee? This is
Both of you.
Okay, Eugenio, why don't you go first? I'll go second.
Okay. I think that it's important to explore alternatives and even more to test the cosmological constant scenario. It is to look for deviations from A equal to W equal to minus 1 or the evolution in time of W, eventual evolution in time. So this is testing the lambda CDM scenario. This is important. So I completely agree with, I like all the efforts of the Dark Energy Task Force. What I'm saying is that this doesn't mean that we don't have a theoretical candidate. It is simply a cosmological constant. When we try to look for other proposals or you try to parameterize deviations from this scenario, then you can have problems. Then it's difficult to account for observational data. But this is different from saying that we don't have any theoretical candidates for the origin of cosmic acceleration.
Okay. Okay, we'll come back. Thank you.
Okay, so my comment is similar, but not exactly the same. Namely, that it is very important to test even the leading scenarios. After all, for example, general relativity is a leading theory of gravity, but we continue to test it to more and more accuracy and so on. So it's very, very important. But it is one thing to do that, and the other thing to say that there is a compelling reason that there is something wrong with the standard scenario, and therefore we should we are compelled to look for something else. And if, in fact, the determination of the parameter W is supposed to be driven by the idea that there is something wrong, and the reason why there is something wrong is that there is a coincidence problem, I wouldn't agree with that at all. If the question is, should we determine W more accurately, I would say absolutely yes, because we have to test the cosmological scenarios more and more accurately.
Okay.
Are there other questions, comments?
Why don't you continue?
Okay, we can go to part 3, slide 11, the problem of quantum field theory vacuum energies. This is often presented as the strongest counterargument to lambda. So I want to sharpen the question. Do vacuum energies gravitate? So let's go to slide 12. Now, in quantum field theory, the vacuum energy density diverges quadratically with the physical ultraviolet cutoff, that I'll denote MUV. And when you compute the vacuum expectation value of the energy momentum tensor, you get a behavior that is like a cosmological constant. So this is a severe problem if this contributes to the effective cosmological constant, because the hypothetical contribution is enormously larger than the observed value of lambda. The observed value, we saw, is associated to a radius of curvature that is 10 to the 26 meters, while if we take as ultraviolet cutoff the Planck scale, we get a radius of curvature that is 10 to the minus 35 meters, that is easily excluded observationally. So here there's an open puzzle of quantum field theory in the presence of gravity. Now, I want to stress that the problem pertains to quantum field theory, not to general relativity with a cosmological constant. It's a mistake to identify lambda with the vacuum energy. In particular, the problem does not affect the lambda CDM model. It's a problem in quantum field theory that once solved, or if it is solved, the solution would not affect the present description of the observational data. Still, it is a problem in quantum field theory, and the way I've presented it in this first part of the slide, I think it's rather naive. It's not enough to say that it's a problem, to say that the vacuum energy density diverges quartically with the cutoff. I want to sharpen the problem. We are working on quantum gravity. We are interested in this problem, if there is a problem. We want to know exactly what is the problem, if there is one. So the vacuum energy density, is it real? This is the question that I would like to discuss. Can it be measured? Does it gravitate? So I've organized this part of the talk in the following way. There's a first part, discussion part, where I consider the Casimir effect, the vaporization heat in solids, and loop corrections to the mass of nuclei. And the second part, where I discuss effective field theory, naturalness, and subtraction. Okay, let's go to slide 13, Casimir effect. Casimir effect is often presented as an argument for the reality of vacuum energies. You consider two metallic plates at a distance A, vacuum of the electromagnetic field in between. And you get a contribution to the energy that has a first part, E0, that is quartically divergent with the cutoff. Now, here, reasonable cutoff is, metallic plates have to impose boundary conditions. They have to be reflecting, but we know that they become transparent for hard X-rays. So a reasonable cutoff is 10 keV. Okay? And then there's a second part that is finite, delta E, and it is negative h-bar of distance to the fourth power at the density. Now, the Casimir effect, in fact, probes only the dependence of this delta E on external parameters, on boundary conditions. While, as far as the first term is concerned, the quartically divergent term, there's a physical argument that is depicted in this figure on the right, that this term does not contribute to the inertial mass of the box. And therefore, thanks to what we know about the equivalence of the inertial mass to the gravitational mass observationally, it should not gravitate. In fact, we do not expect that the two plates have, when they are closed, have a larger mass, but in fact we expect a smaller mass because of the binding energy. And the second point that I want to stress in this slide is that when one considers a standard calculation in quantum field theory on a curved background, for instance, on an S3 universe of radius A, one finds that the renormalized energy momentum tensor gives, on the vacuum state, gives a contribution that depends on the radius of the universe, but in particular it is small. It's a quantum effect that would not be observable in the present universe. And moreover, if you look at rho A and PA as computed by Ford in 76, you realize that it does not behave as a cosmological constant. So there is a contribution coming from vacuum energies, but not a contribution that contributes to the cosmological constant. Okay, questions, comments on the Casimir effect? Otherwise, we can go to slide 14. Well, I'd like to...
This is Gulam.
Can you summarize again? So for Casimir effect, your point of view is that, in fact, if I did quantum field theory in curved space-time, then there is actually a vacuum contribution to the stress energy tensor, and that you think should gravitate, but that contribution is much too small and does not look like a cosmological constant. Is that a fair summary?
Yes. This is the point. Do you agree with it?
Yeah, I agree with that. So thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Okay, let's go to slide 14.
Hello, this is Gulam. I have a question.
Yes.
My question is that in the formula that we have on the slide, the rho is goes as 1 over 8 to the power 4. If vacuum energy indeed gravitated, then when A was very small, the vacuum energy, in fact, should dominate, right? I mean,
yes.
It should gravitationally dominate.
Yes, this would be important in the early stages of the expansion of the universe.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, slide 14. So the question is, do zero-point energy really exist? For instance, the zero-point energy of the harmonic oscillator, the 1/2 h-bar omega. So this question was posed by Nernst. There was a long discussion with Nernst, with Einstein, and with Otto Stern, the one of the Stern-Gerlach experiment at the first Solvay conference in 1911. Well, Nernst was posing the question sharply. He was asking, is there a physical process that allows to measure the 1/2 h-bar omega? Okay. Now, in 1913, Stern, looking at the Bormann-Karman process, realized that in order to explain experimental data on the heat of complete vaporization of monatomic solids, you need to take into account the zero-point energy. So it is real. It is there. You cannot do without it. Okay, but notice, look at the picture on the right. Here there's the levels of an harmonic oscillator, but in the case of complete vaporization, you need to take into account that this is in fact a potential well. There's an energy where you get free atoms, okay? And the process considered by Stern is sensitive only to the ionization energy, to the difference of E3 and H bar, E3 minus H bar omega, not to the zero point energy. So this shows that zero point energies are there, but does not point to the fact that they gravitate. So I wanted to stress this fact. This is, I find it interesting. So are there comments on this?
The argument does not say it gravitates, but on the other hand, are you now saying that not all energy gravitates? That basically is what you are saying? I mean, is it not going against some equivalence principle?
It's not going against some equivalence principle, and it's pointing out something that we see again and again, that it's difference in energies that are important, and it's important to identify the fact that there is a free energy, that there is an energy of free particles to be compared to bound particles, and this is what looks like to be relevant in each situation. But more than this, I wanted to pose the question.
Can I suggest another example? Consider a hydrogen molecule, which has a zero. It is like a harmonic oscillator at low energies, and it has a zero point energy. Are you really suggesting that the zero point energy of the ground state of the hydrogen molecule doesn't contribute to its gravitational mass? Would you say it doesn't contribute to its inertial mass also?
Can you repeat the question, please?
Well, unless I'm mistaken in my memory, a hydrogen molecule acts like a harmonic oscillator and has a zero point energy.
Yes.
And that zero point energy is measured, for example, in the heat of disassociation of hydrogen molecules to individual hydrogen atoms, again, if I remember correctly. And are you really suggesting that contributes neither to inertial nor gravitational mass?
Oh, okay, I understand the question now. So I think that this is another example of this same process of complete vaporization. For instance, you can consider biatomic molecules, like hydrogen molecules. And so you would have the energy of two free nuclei, or the situation where they are bound. Okay, so here you have a binding energy. What you expect is that the mass of the system is smaller than the mass of the two or three nuclei, right? So I completely agree that I expect that this would gravitate. In fact, in the next slide, I'll show a situation where it is known that they gravitate. What I'm trying to argue here, is that what is important is the difference between the energy of free particles, or free hydrogen atom, with respect to the energy of the bound system. So this points out that this is difference of energy that is relevant, not the zero-point energy compared to a classical zero of the potential. If you look at the picture, there's the 1/2 H bar omega that is the difference between the n equals zero level and the classical zero of the potential. And I'm asking, is there a process that measures this difference?
No, the appropriate question, like Lee was saying, I mean, Lee is completely right. With this hydrogen molecule, you have got vibrational degrees of freedom, and those vibrational degrees of freedom are completely described by a harmonic oscillator. And so the question is, if I had a whole bunch of molecules which were in their ground state with respect to the vibrational degree of freedom, then would I not be able to actually measure the gravitational field contribution to the gravitational field from this energy? Let me say, put it differently. I got a neutron star, say, and supposing all the neutrons somehow are in their least possible energy state, which is subject to the Pauli principle. We have no doubt that they gravitate enormously, and it's not true that what matters is only the difference between the ground state energy and the energy of ionization, the energy which will set these neutrons free. For every process other than gravitation, the value of the ground state energy doesn't matter, but it would seem to me that just by a strong test of equivalence principle, that the value of the absolute value of the ground state energy does matter gravitationally.
Okay, this is an important point. You are saying that the mass of a neutron star is not smaller than the sum of the masses of the neutrons because there's a contribution from vacuum energies. No, you're not saying this.
You're saying that, well, what matters is only differences of energy. And I'm saying that, no, I just can't calculate the ground state energy of this assembly of neutron stars. And that is what gravitates. I mean, if a neutron star. Okay, so somehow it's not, so you are agreeing that it's not just the delta E that matters, but the ground state energy also matters.
Oh, yes, okay. So I agree that it is not just the delta E that matter, gravity couples to the mass of the system. What I'm arguing in this slide is that one has to be careful. The 1/2 h bar omega is the difference between the classical zero of the potential and the energy of the vacuum state. And I don't know a situation where it's this one that matters.
So I have a question for Abhay and Lee. Are you saying that this is the way things should be, or are you saying that these are things that you can actually experimentally measure, for instance, with a neutron star or with a hydrogen molecule?
I cannot point out to a specific experiment, but I have no doubt that this is what would be measured. I mean, assuming that the equivalence principle has been tested and it continues to be valid, then this is what is measured. This is what I would say.
But there is an open question if the equivalence principle applies to the Cassinian energy, and I don't know of any experiment that actually has measured that.
Okay, so the statement would be that if one is saying that, in fact, equivalence principle doesn't apply to the ground state energy, it's an earth-shattering claim that I think could be falsified very quickly. I agree with you that I cannot point out to a specific experiment which will just say this, but I think it would be an astonishing prediction. Let me just put it this way.
Okay. Interesting. So let me summarize this slide, saying that there is a set of processes that are sensitive to vacuum energy, but this set of processes, like the heat of vaporization, are sensitive to the difference of the free energy with respect to the vacuum energy. These are in a non-gravitational context, okay? So this does not address the question of does it gravitate or not. Now, let's go to slide 15, where the question about if this correction, this quantity is gravitate or not is discussed. So this comes from a remark by Polchinski in a more recent survey conference. He says, we know that in some situations, loop corrections do gravitate. For instance, the electrostatic contribution to the mass of a nucleus. And he asks, why the analogous loops should not gravitate in a vacuum environment? Okay, so I find that this is a way of sharpening the question. I've been looking for examples, physical examples, or situations where where there are quantum corrections that can matter. So here, one is looking at the electrostatic contribution to the mass of a nucleus, and you find that for aluminium, the contribution is 1 per mil, and for platinum is 3 times 1 per mil, so they are different. So these are contributions to the energy of the nucleus, to the mass, and one can ask if it gravitates. Well, here in this situation, there are experimental results by Dicke. We know that aluminium and platinum have the same ratio of gravitational to inertial mass to 1 part in 10 to the 12th. Okay, so this is a situation where one can close the argument. One knows that there is a correction to the energy, to the mass of the nucleus, and this should gravitate. There's experimental evidence it does gravitate. So, the question is really, we know that it does in the environment of a nucleus, so why it should not in the vacuum environment? Well, I would like at least to point out that the contribution to the mass of the nucleus is only the logarithmic part of the loop correction. There's no ultraviolet cutoff to the fourth power. Okay, are there comments, questions on this point, on this slide?
Just a question. So you have looked in detail at Dickey's paper, because these arguments are extremely tricky about trying to see what one is actually measuring. If you have looked at it, that's fine with me. But if not, then I think somebody should look at it. Maybe I could look at it. But I just wanted to ask if, in fact, you have looked at Dickey's analysis carefully to see that he's really exactly talking about the thing that Polchinski, or the vacuum bubbles that Polchinski is talking about.
So I've not looked in detail at Dickey's paper. I'm taking this as a fact. This is, correct me if I'm wrong, this is about the ratio of the gravitational to the inertial mass, while what Polchinski is pointing out is, let's look at the energy, the inertial mass of the nucleus, and we know that there are a contribution comes from loop corrections that is different in the case of aluminium from the case of platinum. So one can argue, well, there is this correction to the inertial mass, but it does not gravitate. Well, what Polchinski points out is that this can be excluded thanks to Dicke's results. So do you see a problem with this argument? Or do you see?
It's not that I see any problem, but I think that when Dickey's conclusion of 1 part in 10 to the 12 is arrived in very, very carefully and systematically, and somebody, I mean, you could have done it or Polchinski could have done it, should have gone, and if they have gone through this argument very carefully to see that, in fact, it is true that delta E upon M nucleus, as far as this calculation is concerned, is three times bigger in platinum than in aluminium, then I'm fine with it. But the argument is subtle about, you know, how everything is taken into account, and then things are divided by some other quantities in order to account for the experiment. So if somebody has done it, I have no doubt that, you know, some competent person has done it. I have no reason to doubt it at all. But I just wanted to make sure that somebody has done it. Thank you.
Okay, I see your point.
Maybe here I'm on your side here. The question that Polchinski is raising, why isn't the answer just I mean, the check of the equivalence principle by Dickey shows that that quantum fluctuations or loops and diagrams contribute both to inertial mass and gravitational mass. But I don't see a convincing argument that that means you can take the little piece of the diagram with the nucleus in it and remove the nucleus and get a valid conclusion about just the interaction of the vacuum diagrams with the gravitational field.
Thank you very much for this comment. So this is what I'm trying to point out. I'm trying to sharpen the question. Is there a problem? So I'm trying to find all the sharpest, neatest way to identify what is the problem. In each case, it seems to be weak. This argument looks weak. Even if we knew experimentally that it is gravitating in the nucleus environment, why this goes on to the vacuum environment? Is it so straightforward? So this is what I wanted to point out. There are arguments for the problem of vacuum energies in quantum field theory and its contribution to the cosmological constant, but all the ones that I know of this kind. Comments on this? Otherwise, we can go to slide 16.
Yeah, let's do that, and we'll come back to 15 at the end of the talk if there is this, if there is time for discussion. Thank you.
Okay.
The question then, if you want to sharpen your argument, what would be the argument you would use to make a difference between, you know, the loops in the environment of boson or just the loops in vacuum?
I would try to make sense of this loop in vacuum within quantum field theory, or maybe better within effective field theory. It is what I would like to discuss in the next two slides. Okay, so you can ask again after these two slides. So this is about the vacuum. So slide 16. So let me pose it as a question. Why the mass of the electron is about half an MeV and not much larger? And similarly, why rho lambda is of the order of 10 to the minus 3 electron volt to the fourth power and not much larger? Well, the statement that it is often heard is that quantum field theory gives the wrong prediction for lambda. But this is not correct. Yeah, quantum field theory simply gives no prediction. Standard quantum field theory allows to describe how coupling constants renormalize with the scale, not to predict their value. In fact, when people refer to it, this is sharpening the statement. This is to be compared with the current paradigm in the high energy phenomenology community. It is effective field theory, or if you prefer, quantum field theory plus the natural mass principle. This is a fruitful point of view. In this paradigm, the physical cutoff is the scale of new physics, and the low-energy dimensionful constants are the scale of the cutoff, unless they are protected, for instance, by a symmetry. Now, within effective field theory, the natural value of the vacuum energy density in flat space is the mass of the cutoff to the fourth power. Well, unless a symmetry protects it to zero. Okay, so this is the argument in effective field theory in flat space. But the question again is, does it gravitate? One has to look at the coupling with gravitons, at least. Okay, let's go to slide 17. Because one can ask, should I trust these quadratic divergences? Well, Slide 17 is in fact an ode to effective field theory reasoning. It has worked many times. This is the argument. Quadratic divergences in quantum field theory are interesting as they can be used to estimate the scale of new physics. There's an old rather simple example it is the electromagnetic pure mass difference. It's easy because it can be just done in ordinary QED. Well, ordinary QED, but in the effective field theory paradigm. You have to look at this loop diagram and look at the fact that it's quadratically divergent. This loop diagram would give a contribution to the mass of the charged pions. You know the difference of masses between the charged pion and the neutral pion, and this can be used to use the experimental data to predict the scale of the physical cutoff. So this would give a prediction of the mass of the cutoff here, that is the rho particle. Well, this was not a prediction because it was done after the rho was discovered, but in the celebrated GEM mechanism, Blaschke-Yopoulos-Mayani in the 70s, this was actually a prediction, the prediction of the charm quark. And this is also the argument that is behind the expectation for new physics at the TEV scale from the quadratic divergences in the mass of X. So it has worked, and it is working in many situations. So the question is, quantic divergences in the vacuum energies give a prediction? What is the prediction that they give? Now, I think the point here is that it is dangerous to extend flat space arguments to cold space without the Duke crash. In particular, the first point is that one can look at those loop diagrams in the vacuum that we were discussing before. And when one does this in the effective field theory paradigm, one gets that they give a dimension 4 term. There would be a cosmological constant term. But if you consider gravitons and standard model matter on flat Minkowski space, this dimension 4 terms decouple for gravitons. So this indicates that they don't gravitate. Now, this is effective field theory on flat space with gravitons. And one can ask, what happens if one goes to effective field theory on a curved space? Well, I want to point out here that there's a recent paper by Michele Maggiore that I find interesting. He considers the vacuum energies in the effective field theory paradigm for a Friedman Robertson Walker universe. And he considers a subtraction like the one for the ADM mass. And what he finds is a quadratic divergence. Well, an effect that is that depends quadratically on the mass in physics. It's mass squared times Abel constant squared. And this is compatible with present constraints. And moreover, it does not behave as a cosmological constant. So to summarize, the standard argument that quartic divergences in effective field theory would contribute to the cosmological constant, but they are larger, is always formulated in effective field theory on flat Minkowski space. So this does not indicate that this quartic divergence is gravitating.
Could you tell us a little bit more about this last point about the effective field theory in Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe? What system is one considering? So this is presumably quantum field theory in curved space-time. Is that what it is? Or is this semi-classical gravity in which back reaction is also included, and that is why one can calculate ADM mass? And how can you calculate ADM mass in a FRW universe, because that would just be infinite? So can you tell us a little bit more about what this calculation is?
Yes. So this is a nice paper. So it is about, he considers a massless scalar field in Freeman-Roberts work. He considers it's a dynamical Freeman-Roberts work. Yeah, by ADM mass, the subtraction is inspired by the subtraction that you consider for asymptotically flat space. Yeah, what it means is that it is subtracting the contribution for that you get for a very large scale factor. Okay, so what it's subtracting is the quartically divergent term. So the naive divergence will be quartic in the ultraviolet cutoff. Once you subtract it, you get a quadratic divergence. It is the one that I've written here. And this is to be compared to what is done in standard quantum field theory on Kurth space-time, where standard renormalization techniques would set to zero also this quadratic divergence and would give only contributions that do not depend on the ultraviolet cutoff.
Maybe to go along your line, there is also the fact that if you do in dimension 4 dimensional regularization, quartic divergences will be renormalized to zero. So there will be no quartic divergence in dimensional regularization.
Yes, right. Right. Yes. So, yes. So I'll try to stress this point. I think it's important. So if you work with standard quantum field theory, you choose your regularization. So, for instance, dimensional regularization is very practical. And if you take this seriously, you are not all the quadratic and quartic divergences are set to zero automatically. Now, this means that you are not able to estimate the scale of new physics as you do in effective field theory. For instance, if you take this seriously, you would not expect new physics at the Tev scale because of the quadratic divergence of the mass of Higgs. So effective field theory reasoning is adding something else, is taking seriously this cutoff. Laurent, do you agree with this way of presenting it?
Sorry?
Do you agree with this statement, this way of the dimensional regularization sets the quadratic and quartic divergences to zero? So it's practical in standard quantum field theoretical calculations, but you are missing something. You are missing the opportunity to estimate the scale of new physics, as you do in often doing phenomenology.
Yeah, I agree. There is a puzzle there. There's a puzzle.
Okay, so in the... Yes?
Can just go on, I think. We can finish and then we can come back to discussion.
Okay. So there was a question in the very beginning, I think, by Lee. It was about the order of magnitude. Cosmological constant has its own order of magnitude that is typical length scale, 10 to the 26 meters, while there's another scale, it is the Planck scale. Should we be able to predict the scale of the cosmological constant, for instance, looking at fundamental scales in particle physics or in high energy physics? Now, if my understanding of the problem is that this kind of reasoning is effective field theory reasoning. So if I want to formulate it, if I want to be able to predict a scale, like the scale of the cosmological constant, I have to formulate it within effective field theory. And when I try to do it, what I realize is that effective field theory is not telling me anything about the scale of the cosmological constant. This is the way the problem appears to me now. So often one poses the problem, okay, we observe a cosmological constant, but we don't understand its magnitude. We don't understand what is the origin of this scale. Well, this is because one is expecting to be able to predict this in terms of high energy physics, while it may very well be that this is a fundamental scale of our theory. Why not? Okay, so I want to summarize slide 18. So general relativity with a cosmological constant. This description is empirically adequate. The lambda cold dark matter model is today the standard model of cosmology and is almost universally accepted by cosmologists as the best description of the present data, as stressed by Lavalid. It is theoretically consistent. Lambda is completely natural part of general relativity. It is no more nor less mysterious than any other of the numerous constants in fundamental theories. There are open issues, for instance, why quantum field theory vacuum energies do not appear not to contribute to lambda, what happens in phase transitions. But these pertain to other domains of physics, not to the problem of the physical reason for the accelerated expansion of the universe. I want also to stress that it is important to keep testing the lambda scenario and continue to explore alternative ideas. For instance, there are data on parametrizations. W is minus one precision of one tenth. And one aspect is constant in time. So it's important to invest on this. On the other hand, if you look at page 19, this is the way the cosmic acceleration is often presented. You can often find statements like this. Arguably, the greatest mystery of humanity today is the prospect that 75% of the universe is made up of a substance known as dark energy, about which we have almost no knowledge at all. Or, dark energy remains a mystery. We are frustrated by the lack of theoretical candidates for it. Well, this is exaggerated, I think, we believe. So on slide 20, you can find the summary. We must keep testing the lambda CDM scenario and continue to explore alternative ideas. But to say lack of theoretical candidates or great mystery for cosmic acceleration is badly misleading. It's especially wrong to talk about a substance. It is like saying that the centrifugal force that pushes out from a merry-go-round is the effect of a mysterious substance. The acceleration in the cosmic expansion is well understood and well accounted for by current fundamental physical theory. It is not due to a vacuum energy or a mysterious substance. It is a long-distance repulsive force due to the intrinsic dynamics of geometry. There's no great mystery here. Thank you.
So we have time for comments.
Maybe on the conclusion, I mean, you're saying there's no mystery, which I agree with. Still, people are worried about the issue of naturalness. So there's a scale which is there, and you know, I guess that's what most people worry about: the question of naturalness, fine-tuning, or try to, you know, find an explanation for the scale. Maybe, you know, it's used. What are you arguing with respect to that?
Yes, I think it's important to formulate sharply the problem of naturalness. So naturalness is a principle that is implemented in effective field theory. So I'd like to see this made precisely within an effective field theory. And the examples that I've seen indicate that these contributions either don't gravitate. So one is not saying anything about the cosmological constant because one is considering effective field theory on flat space. So either there's not a lot done in effective field theory on cold space, this is interesting, this is important, but what it is pointed out by the attempts in this direction is that the contribution is quadratic, not quartic, and it's not the form of a cosmological constant. Particular seems not to contribute to the cosmic acceleration at all, because it has a pressure that is minus one-third the density. But still, I agree with you. There's something to be understood within quantum field theory.
Can I add a comment?
There's Carlo that is calling from Paris, and he has a comment. I hope you can hear him.
Yes, I can say this, and maybe Eugenio can repeat it. If it's not, if the others cannot hear, I will be very short.
Yes?
We can hear.
Sometimes naturalness are invoked as a problem in talking about cosmological constants in a much more naive sense. Simply meaning we have measured a constant which is on a scale which is different from other scales of constants we've measured so far. So it's a new scale, and therefore it is a natural. I think that in this way, it's nevertheless
online where you were speaking about the experimental evidence for gravitation due to H omega, and I found that there's a proposed space mission called Satellite Energy Exchange, and that John Moffat proposed an experiment for that mission that would test if H omega gravitates. Apparently for a ball of aluminum, H omega is about 10 to the minus 14 to the mass, so it's very difficult to measure. But I don't find any evidence that this mission is going to fly anytime soon.
Thank you. I suspect people have some mic open. If you are not speaking, please switch off your mic.
I bet there is a lot of noise when you speak. We cannot hear you properly here at LSU.
Okay. I think there is a lot of more. But I think the way I'm saying. So let's just speak at 1 second.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. <Good
work.
laughs>
Ci sono, ma.
Hey, Carlo, are you there?
Well, I think that Lee is trying to greet